An Ohio river town is trying to find a balance between clean air and industrial jobs.
You know, I'm not against a clean environment, but I think that there's a trade-off of how clean do you go if it costs you, you know, high-paying jobs.
I'm Kara Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, how people in East Liverpool, Ohio, are reacting to cleaning up manganese pollution. Plus, a group of doctors in New York is concerned about the public health risks of fracking.
One of the problems is that we don't know all of the problems that can occur. We know enough to know that there are dangers.
And students in struggling coal communities are imagining new ways to power their future.
So what we're trying to do is create hydrogen gas to then put into a fuel cell to create electricity.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. Environmental groups have appealed another coal mining permit for CONSOL Energy. The permit is to mine beneath a stream inside a state park in Greene County. It's part of CONSOL's plan to expand its Bailey mine. For State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports it's the latest in a string of legal battles over the project.
Earlier this month, the Department of Environmental Protection approved a permit that would allow CONSOL to use longwall mining beneath a section of Poland Run, which flows through Ryerson Station State Park. The technique can cause the ground beneath a stream to fall in, opening up cracks in its stream bed. Last year, a panel of environmental judges overturned a previous DEP permit for the mine. But CONSOL says this section of the stream has different geology and won't get damaged from mining beneath it. Even if it does, the company says it can seal any cracks. Veronica Koptis of the Center for Coalfield Justice, one of the groups suing to stop the permit, says the plan still puts the stream at risk.
Nothing has changed in the geology of the stream. Nothing has changed in the technique of mining that they're doing. And so we still believe that these same predictions hold true.
The groups have asked a judge to put an emergency halt to the permit while the case is decided. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
Imagine being told that your children have high levels of manganese, an industrial metal, in their bodies, and it'll impact their health and lives forever. That's what some parents in East Liverpool, Ohio, heard. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency recently signed a settlement to reduce manganese pollution from the Pittsburgh-based S.H. Bell Company. Their industrial facility sits along the Ohio River on the Pennsylvania-Ohio border. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports that while some people who live near the plant are satisfied with the deal, others are still concerned about the impact on children's health.
The consent decree negotiated between the U.S. EPA and S.H. Bell spells out requirements for air monitoring and reduction of manganese blowing from the company's 92-acre facility. Spanning both East Liverpool, Ohio and Ohioville, Pennsylvania, it processes and transports metals. In a complaint against S.H. Bell, the federal government says emissions of ambient manganese from the plant present, quote, an imminent and substantial endangerment to public health under the Clean Air Act. And according to Amanda Kiger, you can see the rusty brown coating from it on nearby houses.
It's like a gritty, powdery substance.
Kiger is an environmental activist in East Liverpool. She has four grandchildren living there and says the problem is worst on the low-income residential streets that lead up to the plant.
So kids are going out, there's manganese dust on their bikes, on their slides. So they're out there playing, and you know kids, they're sweating, they wipe their face, put their hands in their mouth, you know, all the things that kids do.
A study by the University of Cincinnati, published in the journal Neurotoxicology, looked at more than 100 children in East Liverpool. It found an association between higher levels of manganese in their hair with lower IQ scores.
It's just horrifying.
S.H. Bell disputes the findings, and the study did not identify the company, as there are multiple sources of manganese in the area. Amid the used furniture and trinket shops in downtown East Liverpool, Diana Cable works at a new lunch place. She hasn't heard about the impact of manganese on the IQ of local kids.
We can't be harming our children and families.
But Cable says S.H. Bell and a controversial hazardous waste incinerator near downtown are both important in this community, and she trusts them.
Yes, these companies have been here for many years, and they've provided work for people in the area, you know, as with, like, the coal mines.
She knows many coal miners have gotten sick from their work, but this region has lost many coal jobs as well as its ceramics industry. Sitting at the counter, salesman Chris McNichol says East Liverpool needs to hold on to the industries that remain.
The area itself, you know, over its history has always sacrificed the environment to some degree for good industrial jobs, you know, dating back to the pottery and the steel days.
This region voted for President Trump. An analysis by the New York Times finds that environmental enforcement actions against polluters has dropped under his administration. Between spoonfuls of soup, McNichol says he agrees with Trump's anti-regulation stance.
You know, I'm not against a clean environment, but I think there's a trade-off of, you know, how clean do you go if it costs you, you know, high-paying jobs.
But some people here want more accountability. Late last year, the East Liverpool City Council sent a letter to the EPA demanding action against that hazardous waste incinerator owned by Heritage Thermal Services. Under Obama, the EPA filed a notice of violation against it for repeatedly releasing pollutants into the air. But EPA says there's been no resolution to that notice. Meanwhile, activist Amanda Kiger sees the region's future not in the jobs provided by these companies, but in protecting the health and intellectual capacity of the people who live here.
They are being poisoned with things that literally harm their decision-making processes and their ability to learn. That's also going to be shown in what the economic viability of that community looks like.
Still, Kiger calls the EPA's consent decree against S.H. Bell a good first step. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
The public health impacts of fracking have long been a concern for community members living near shale drilling operations, for activists, and for doctors. Over the last 4 years, the Concerned Health Professionals of New York and Physicians for Social Responsibility have compiled a list of studies and reports which outline what they call the risks and harms of fracking to public health. It's a compendium of articles from peer-reviewed medical or scientific journals, investigative reports by journalists, and reports from or commissioned by government agencies. It's over 250 pages online, organized along themes like air pollution, earthquakes, and climate change. I talked with pediatrician Larissa Durska, one of its authors, about the latest edition of the Compendium of Scientific, Medical, and Media Findings Demonstrating Risks and Harms of Fracking, which came out this month.
This is the fifth edition since July 2014. What's notable that's new? How has it changed?
We have now almost 1,300 references that we have compiled. Our first one was about 5 years ago, and there were very, very few. It was a small pamphlet at that point. We also have groupings of issues that we have started expanding, and that includes now infrastructure such as pipelines and compressor stations, because we found that those are also contributing significantly to health impacts.
Are there studies or reports, especially newer studies or reports, that particularly concern you?
I'm a retired pediatrician, so I've always reflected on what could impact children in particular because they're such a vulnerable population. With a group of colleagues from the Center for Environmental Health and also some from Concerned Health Professionals of New York, I've been a co-author on a couple of peer-reviewed papers that includes respiratory effects and another one more recently published in October of 2017 on the neurological impacts on children of several components that are emitted during fracking operations, particulate matter, ozone, benzene, And they are significant, they're real, and we feel that not enough attention has been paid to the health issue from the very beginning.
In the compendium, there is sort of a list of takeaways, and one of them is that fracking is a threat to public health and that no regulations can make it safe. You really don't think that more or different regulations would make fracking safer for the public? How did you come to that conclusion?
I agree wholeheartedly with that conclusion. We have seen in other places where there have been regulations implemented, and they have not protected health. So, for example, even in Pennsylvania, there are some regulations in place. But either you have a political environment where you can't impose or then enforce. It's very difficult to enforce, by the way, too. Now, of course, we live in New York State, but we've traveled. Pennsylvania is just across the river from me, and I have spent time in Pennsylvania and in West Virginia, and I've talked to people, and I know they're getting sick. And one of the problems is that we don't know all of the problems that can occur still. We know enough to know that there are dangers and that there are risks to public health. As if you read the compendium on the risks to infants, the number of children and babies who are born to mothers close to gas wells have more low birth weight problems and the complications thereof. There are regulations in place where you can't put a well, you know, closer than a few hundred feet from a school or from a home, but obviously, these are not working. We need more research to find out what the exact risk is and how close that risk is, but we don't know all of that. And so we feel that it's best to follow the precautionary principle, which says don't do the harm if you are alerted to the dangers and you don't know what the outcome is going to be for a large part of the population. You can't risk, especially with our children. You can't take those risks. A moratorium is a logical sort of middle-of-the-road way to start by, while you're addressing any regulations that you might be thinking of, put a moratorium on because you're concerned enough based on the information that's available, such as in our compendium.
How has the compendium been used by activists, policymakers, even researchers in the past, and how do you hope this information in the new edition will be used?
So, for example, Florida was considering some regulations and possibly some legislation that would be protective. And obviously, water is a big issue for Florida. And so we put out that one section of the compendium early. And so that was available to Florida. And then we also used that section. I used it in my testimony to the Delaware River Basin Commission, which is considering a ban on fracking on its lands. People who live near these sites, this is very readable. For each reference, we present a summary that we wrote. That's about one paragraph long. And so that's very, very accessible to the general public. So we have heard that people in the general population are using this to inform themselves.
Do you feel a sense of urgency with this work?
Yes, and especially in this environment.
You mean this political environment?
Yes. And it's, you know, we're fortunate to live in New York State, but, you know, our neighbor is Pennsylvania. And we wish that we could inform that government more and better. We wish that the industry didn't have such a free hand in Pennsylvania. I mean, whatever happens in Pennsylvania comes across to New York as well. And yes, the urgency of climate change. I mean, we all have families and children and or grandchildren, and we're very concerned about the future for them. And we do have a short time frame to turn this around. So that urgency is there, the urgency that our friends or colleagues or people that we've heard about or have had occasion to speak with in Pennsylvania or West Virginia are getting sick. There are people who are no longer with us who were activists and had complained about health issues that they had or their animals had, and they're gone. So, yeah, there's an urgency to record it and to make people aware.
Thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you, Kara.
Dr. Larissa Derska is a pediatrician and founder of Concerned Health Professionals of New York. And she talked with me from her home about their compendium for scientific, medical, and media findings demonstrating risks and harms of fracking. There's more at AlleghenyFront.org. This is The Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for The Allegheny Front comes from the Center for Environmental Research and Education at Duquesne University, now celebrating 25 years of preparing environmental professionals. The center provides multidisciplinary education for careers in environmental science and management with opportunities for research and internships. Programs include a BS in Environmental Science, Master's in Environmental Science and Management, and professional certificate programs. More information on the Center for Environmental Research and Education can be found at duq.edu/ESM.
Carbon dioxide emissions from the use of energy rose by 1.4% in 2017. That's according to new data released by the International Energy Agency. It looks like economic growth led to increased energy demand from oil and gas, renewables, and coal. Emissions from coal contributed a lot to that rise, but globally, new coal plants are on the decline, a steep decline. The coal industry's decline in the U.S. has been hard on many in the Ohio Valley, including school districts. Tax revenue from mining has decreased, along with the local economy, while rising electricity rates make it a struggle to keep schools open. But as Ohio Valley Resources' Benny Becker reports, students there are trying to create a new energy future.
Arley Boggs Elementary sits between Kentucky's two tallest mountains in an area that once had a booming coal economy. 10 years ago, there were over 1,000 coal miners employed here in Letcher County. Today, there are just 28.
Our community was left with many unemployed miners. Paying bills had become a hardship for many. We wondered what we could do to help reduce costs in our homes and our schools.
Our answer was literally right over our heads the entire time.
Nicholas Sturgill and Allison Pendleton were part of an 8th grade class that researched solar panels and got a set installed on their school's roof. Their teacher, Myrtle Boggs, explains.
The energy that we will save would be $600 in a school year. We get paid from our district for saving energy, so we are hoping to purchase more solar panels and then eventually get to where we are using very little energy at our school.
Many schools across the Ohio Valley region are struggling with the rising cost of energy. The region's heavy reliance on coal has led power rates to rise faster here than in other parts of the country. At a recent hearing on a proposed power rate increase in eastern Kentucky, the state commissioner of education, Stephen Pruitt, argued that schools wouldn't be able to handle any increased cost.
Right now, many of our schools are literally going week to week to be able to keep the doors open.
The Kentucky Public Service Commission did not grant a rate increase in that case, but the decision brought other hardships for schools. Commissioners had the power company cut costs by scrapping the program that paid customers who invest in energy efficiency. Schools in Letcher County have benefited from the program, which let them upgrade lighting, appliances, heating, and air conditioning. They've managed to lower power bills by more than 10%, saving $130,000 each year.
Every time we did one of those projects, we got a rebate, and that cut our cost in half. Well, we don't do that anymore, so we have to shoulder the whole cost.
That's Sherry Sexton, who oversees energy conservation for schools in Letcher County. Sexton and utility analysts agree there will likely be more power rate increases in coming years. So it's all hands on deck to save energy and cut costs.
These students do little projects, like they'll go around and see how much electricity a soda machine uses and taking the lights out of the front of the machine. So that cuts back on usage and it gets them thinking about how can we cut back at home.
In nearby Floyd County, Kentucky, students have been building models to study how and where buildings lose heat. I spoke to Olivia Stumbo, a 7th grader at Allen Central Middle School.
We had to make a paper house. We measured it using a heat gun as an example about how heat is lost throughout houses.
Do you feel like you learned much from that?
Yes, a lot. The big goal is to apply insulation, and we need to educate the others.
Like the solar effort in Letcher County, Stumbo's project received funding from a regional school district cooperative, Belfry High School in Pike County, Kentucky, used funding from the cooperative to allow students in a ninth grade class to work on one technology project for the whole year. Ryan Varney is part of a group with ambitions to change the future of energy.
So what we're trying to do is create hydrogen gas to then put into a fuel cell to create electricity.
Ryan's teammate, Elissa Stanley, says her motivation comes from what she's seen happen to the local coal mines, where her dad has worked for over 30 years.
It's dying down, and I think there definitely needs to be something there to back it up.
In just 3 weeks, the team of four freshmen created a fuel cell that could propel this model car. Down the road, they hope to help create a new energy economy here in the coal fields. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Benny Becker in Whitesburg, Kentucky.
That story is the latest in the Ohio Valley Resource series, Changing Course. The series is supported by the Solutions Journalism Network. And Ohio Valley Resource is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Alaska is by far the largest state, and 60% of it is owned by the federal government, 225 million acres. So what happens on that public land affects all of us. That's why a portion of the new tax bill passed by Congress, which opens up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in northeastern Alaska to drilling, was so controversial. For environmentalists, drilling there would be disastrous. For wildlife, water, and the climate. But others, like President Trump, say ANWR is a national resource we could be capitalizing on.
I really didn't care about it. And then when I heard that everybody wanted it for 40 years, they've been trying to get it approved. I said, make sure you don't lose ANWR.
For our podcast, Trump on Earth, the Allegheny Friends' Reed Frazier talked about decisions being made in D.C. and their impacts on the 49th state and the rest of us with an expert, Elizabeth Harbaugh. She's a reporter with Alaska Public Media's Energy Desk in Anchorage.
Well, let's talk about another big chunk of land that could have a lot of oil in it, the National Petroleum Reserve. The USGS did a new assessment of the amount of oil that's underneath the National Petroleum Reserve, and it caused some controversy. Can you just first tell us what the National Petroleum Reserve is, or NPR, not to be confused with public radio?
I nerd out over NPRA pretty frequently, because when it comes to what is happening now in Alaska's oil industry, it's really where all the action is. Recently, there have been a number of really huge oil discoveries in and around the National Petroleum Reserve on a scale that has the state quite excited. Those discoveries are pushing the oil industry slowly into the reserve in a way that just didn't happen in previous decades. Under the Obama administration, about half of the reserve had been placed off limits to protect sensitive lands. Notably, there's this lake called Teshikbuk Lake in the north, and it's considered critical habitat for migratory birds, and that whole area is off limits. Well, the oil industry thinks, with good reason, that there's oil potential in a lot of those areas that the Obama administration put off limits. So right now, there's a push with the Trump administration to open those lands up for more development. And that could really happen a lot faster than any development in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And the funny thing about the National Petroleum Reserve Alaska is you talk to environmental groups and they really abhor the name. It just is like the worst branding for them possible, because people think National Petroleum Reserve and they're like, oh, well, this is a place where, you know, naturally we want oil rigs in there. But it's very similar, actually, ecologically to the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Just nobody really pays attention to it.
And they're next to each other, right?
Yeah. Well, there's the National Petroleum Reserve is to the west. And then there's this little tiny triangle of land in the, well, not that tiny, actually, but comparatively. There's a smaller triangle of land where there's Prudhoe Bay. That's the state land. And then to the east of that, that's the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
And Elizabeth, you were saying this is where the action is. Explain that.
It's where I am seeing the most interest on the part of the oil industry to expand into federal lands. ConocoPhillips is already developing in the reserve. It's like adding pearls to a string. They've got one development, and they're kind of edging further and further west. And at this point, they're really like starting to push against that boundary line between what's where drilling is allowed and where the Obama administration set it off limits. And it's really quite incredible. So USGS released that assessment on the amount of oil in the National Petroleum Reserve. And if you look at where USGS thinks the most oil potential is, there's pretty much a bullseye on that off-limits land that environmental groups say is so important. You know, I've talked to Conoco about this. They strongly believe that they can develop there and do it safely and not harm the habitat and the species that live there. Environmental groups, of course, disagree with that. It's kind of this below-the-radar controversy that's probably going to have a lot more near-term impact than anything that's going to happen in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
And what has the Trump administration done or said about NPRA?
They've been pretty explicit that they are interested in changing the management plan that the Obama administration put out. Secretary Ryan Zinke paid a visit to Anchorage, I think it was late last May, and he signed the secretarial order. It was kind of like a catch-all secretarial order, but one of the things was to reevaluate that management plan the Obama administration put down for the National Petroleum Reserve. And by reevaluate, it's pretty much assumed that that means taking some of those off-limits lands and making them available to the oil industry.
Can you describe, like, sort of, you know, the change in the last 12? I guess now we're up to, what is it, miles in the last 14 months? You know, what has the change been in terms of federal policies towards Alaska that you've seen?
I guess there's a couple weeks ago, I think it was late January, where I had just been running around like a chicken with my head cut off, covering decision after decision after, big news story after big news story. And I took a step back and I kind of went, whoa, Congress had opened up the Arctic Refuge to drilling. And the Trump administration had proposed reopening Arctic waters to drilling. And there had also reversed on a course of action on a road on federal land that is pretty controversial, the King Cove Road. And that wasn't necessarily planned. It may have been a coincidence. But within a relatively short period of time, a lot of the biggest fights, biggest environmental fights in Alaska reached pretty major turning points. I don't know if it's entirely sunk in to me. I don't know if it's entirely sunk in to Alaskans, but I think they, at least on paper, at least when it comes to switching around policies that had been in place under the Obama administration, they've actually accomplished quite a lot of what they set out to do in Alaska.
Elizabeth Harbaugh is a reporter with Alaska Public Media's Energy Desk in Anchorage. She spoke with the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier for our podcast, Trump on Earth, about changes in environmental policy under the Trump administration. There's more of the conversation at TrumpOnEarth.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. Find us on Twitter at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is our executive producer. I'm Kara Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Catherine Mabus McKenna Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation.